Where is God when we have questions? I came into both the summer and the scripture today with questions, and in fact, it's been a year of unanswered questions, of praying and hearing nothing, of asking questions and getting silence in response. I have a suspicion I'm not the only one who's ever experienced this. In fact, the scripture passage today tells a story of two people feeling the absence of God and asking questions. But more importantly, I think the two stories also reveal how God responds. At the beginning of the story, we find Mary, Thomas, and the other followers of Jesus reeling from his brutal and violent execution. The disciples appear fractured, grappling with Judas's betrayal and their own fear during the arrest and trial of Jesus. The gospel writers describe various groups within the group, encountering angels or Jesus himself and reporting back to the larger group, but these reports are received with skepticism and disbelief. The remaining Jesus followers gather in locked rooms, and whenever Jesus or angels appear in these accounts, they begin by greeting the disciples with peace, suggesting that the disciples were probably terrified. And this terror and chaos is very understandable. The friend they'd spent the better part of 3 years with had just suffered a horrific execution. Their framework for the world, for who Jesus was, for who the Messiah would be, had been entirely upended. There was likely a real and profound sense that Jesus had failed, abandoned them, and plunged them into a reality where their lives were in greater danger than before. The emotions of this time period feel as though they lift off the page, and perhaps this is because the emotions are not far from us now. The grief the disciples feel at the death of their friend and rabbi is a feeling many of us have felt as well. The God we followed into a challenging position, a new home, a difficult vocation, seemingly abandoning us partway through. Some of us may go through our days with an aching absence of any sense of God's love or presence. Many of our days may feel more like Holy Saturday than Easter Sunday. I think John is writing to this moment. In the text, we find Mary crying in the graveyard, and Thomas isn't with the other disciples when Jesus initially appears to them. Both of these people are alone. Both seem to be searching. Both are experiencing profound grief at the loss of their friend and teacher. And Mary and Thomas weren't casual followers of Jesus. Mary Magdalene had been miraculously healed and was one of the few people who remained with him at the crucifixion, witnessing his death firsthand. Thomas is recorded as being the disciple who urges the group to follow Jesus to Judea despite the risk, saying, "Let us go, that we may all die with him." He would have witnessed the resurrection of Lazarus at Bethany. I mean, these were friends of Jesus who had been loyal. They'd experienced healing. They'd been willing to risk their lives to follow him. But now, Jesus is dead, and they're left with questions. Mary asks both the angels and Jesus where Jesus has gone. Thomas asks for material evidence that Jesus is truly alive. And these are very real human responses. We might find our own questions within Mary and Thomas. When we feel Jesus' absence, we may turn to others to ask where he's gone. We may have agonizing questions about whether the Jesus we risk our lives to follow is actually real, actually God. But what's fascinating about these stories is not just that Mary and Thomas are grieved with questions, it's how Jesus appears and acts. We find Mary weeping outside the tomb when she bends down and sees two angels inside. They ask her a question, "Why are you crying?" She answers, "They've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've put him." At the very moment she expresses her confusion and concern over where Jesus is, she turns around, and Jesus is in fact right there with her. She doesn't recognize him, thinking he's the gardener, and the text doesn't identify why she's unable to recognize her friend. It's a mysterious moment, this tension between Mary searching for Jesus and being unable to see him right in front of her, and the dramatic irony is the hinge of the scene. And perhaps this pause makes us ask the question, when we have seasons of feeling God's absence, of unanswered questions, could it be possible that Jesus is there with us and we're just unable to identify him? The Anabaptist Community Bible notes suggest that while we may think we know what we're looking for, we often don't recognize Jesus when we see him. There's a wry humor to this story, glimmering at the edges of this grievous moment. After all, this God, who is capable of resurrection, is also capable of surprising us. We may think we have a grasp on who Jesus is. We may have followed him around the desert for 3 years. We may have experienced his healing touch. And we may still be completely caught off guard by what God does next. I think it's important not to rush past this moment where Jesus is present with Mary but remains unrecognized. Much of our lives may take place in this kind of moment. The resurrected Christ is near, appearing in response to our questions, and yet we are unable to recognize or receive the comfort of his presence. This inability to perceive Jesus is not due to a sin, a lack of faithfulness, or asking the wrong questions. The text doesn't blame Mary for her inability to perceive Jesus. In many ways, she's done everything right. She's been a faithful follower of Jesus. She looks for him where she knows he's buried. She speaks to angels. She's asking questions and seeking after him. You can do everything right and still not feel the presence of God. And yet, God may still be with you, despite this feeling of absence. I do not know why or how this is. For me, the only comfort here is that when we are in seasons of seeking with no answers, crying out and feeling no comfort, it is not an indictment of ourselves. It is merely a reality that others before us have experienced as well. In this moment where Mary doesn't recognize her friend, Jesus repeats the question the angels asked. Why are you crying? Who are you looking for? Jesus knows Mary. He seems to have appeared as an answer to her question. And yet he still asks her the question. Why are you crying? God doesn't condemn the questions. God becomes the question asker. What are you looking for? He wants to hear what Mary has to say. This humble, searching curiosity paints a picture of a God who is with us in our grief, even when we don't think that God is near. And I find myself again asking the question, why is there this gap between our inability to perceive God's presence and the reality that God is near? At least in this story, the text doesn't answer that question. It just identifies the gap and reveals a God who is near, who asks questions, and eventually reveals himself in a personal way. And God's self-revelation in the story is not summoned by sacrifice, a bargain with God, or a magic word. Mary is not required to attain a certain level of holiness in order to be granted access. Jesus chooses to reveal himself by speaking her name. This moment is in line with Jesus' past self-revelations to the woman at the well, Zacchaeus in the tree, Nathanael under the fig tree. Jesus has always and continues to affirm his character by entering into people's lives and speaking in personal and intimate ways. And everything changes in this moment. The veil is torn and Mary is able to see Jesus. Rabboni, she says, or teacher. It's an intimate moment of both friends naming and seeing the other truly. However, this moment of divine self-revelation is followed by Jesus telling Mary, "Don't hold on to me. I haven't yet gone up to my Father. Go to my brothers and sisters and tell them, I'm going up to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." In this instruction, Jesus refuses to be boxed in by theories, patterns, or predictions. He appears, and then he slips through our fingers again. Jesus is not possessed by anyone, regardless of their personal encounter with him. And when God reveals God's self to us, it is a mystical gift, not an ego boost. After living in Holy Saturdays, we may find ourselves having glimpses and revelations of Easter mornings where God reveals God's self in personal and intimate ways. They are encounters with a God who is much too large to hold on to. Notably, Jesus also immediately shifts from this personal, intimate encounter with Mary to a reminder that the story is about the community of Jesus' followers, not an individualistic experience. He insists she goes to tell his brothers and sisters that he would be returning to his God and their God. Even as Jesus has triumphed over death, he describes himself and his relationship to others and God with profound humility. He balances both intimate personal encounters with a revelation of a God who is for everyone and who sees his beloved followers as siblings. Of course, we must now turn to the story of Thomas. Thomas has not been present with the gathering of disciples who Jesus appeared to. After being part of the 12, part of this inner circle, once willing to follow Jesus unto death in Judea, he now finds himself on the outskirts of the group. His friends tell him about Jesus appearing to them in the upper room, and he immediately expresses that this testimony is not enough to persuade him. He has requirements and criteria for how he would need to encounter Christ. He wants to see the wounds of Jesus himself. Perhaps his witness of Lazarus' resurrection means that he has a particular framework for resurrection that he wants to observe. I empathize with Thomas. When you're in a season of questions, of feeling the absence of God, hearing about the experiences of story and stories of others can ring hollow. Mary's intimate encounter with Jesus might not fulfill the longings and questions of Thomas. We all have different wounds and questions that are particular to us. And just like Mary, Thomas has these questions that Jesus then appears and satisfies. But in this story, Jesus doesn't appear immediately. About a week after Thomas identifies his criteria, Thomas and the other followers of Jesus are gathered in a locked room. This may have been a literal locked room because they were afraid of reprisals from the authorities and religious leaders, but it also indicates a certain fear and closed offness that mirrors Thomas's cold reception of the other disciples' testimony. But Jesus is not deterred by these locked doors, metaphorical or literal. He appears in their midst, stands among them, and greets them with peace. He then turns to Thomas specifically and invites him to place his hands in his wounds. Put your finger here. Look at my hands. Put your hand into my side. Jesus responds to Thomas's questions by humbly exposing a body marked by pain and suffering. A whole sermon series could be preached on the fact that Jesus still has wounds in his resurrected body. Much theology has been born from this reality. For the limited scope of today, it's quite mystical. Jesus is alive. He's defeated the powers of violence, evil, and death. And yet, he still bears the marks. He has been gone. He has been dead. He has been absent. And there are wounds that testify to what Christ has experienced while the disciples have felt alone. In this moment, Thomas declares that Jesus is Lord. It is of note that it is here in the wounds of a body that Thomas is finally able to recognize the divine. This story is the culmination of the text and the miracle that the author decides to record over the apparently endless miracles that Jesus performed after his resurrection. It seems that even post-resurrection, Christ's divinity is once again not exhibited through violently destroying the Roman Empire, burning up his enemies, or wowing the disciples with feats of strength. It is to invite his hurting, abandoned friend to place his hands in the wounds and scars of his body. And although Jesus' body still shows the evidence of the pain he's experienced, his wounds are not a source of bitterness, trauma, or suffering, and instead have become a space to invite others into. Jesus then says to Thomas, "Because you've seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who have seen, who have not seen, and yet have believed." While on first glance, this response of Thomas may seem condemning, the reality is a bit more complex. This final statement leads into the last section of the chapter and operates almost like a fourth wall break. The author of John is using this last statement not as a condemnation of Thomas's desire to see Jesus' wounds for himself, but as a comfort to the generation of Jesus' followers to come, who would not be able to see Christ's physical body themselves. The author turns to the audience and calls us blessed, having believed without having seen. This fourth wall break acts as an invitation to us, to the reader, to step into the story ourselves. Once again, an intimate encounter with the living God is then refracted out to this wider circle of believers. Just as Mary is told not to hold on to Jesus, but instead to tell the other siblings that she has seen the Lord, now Jesus turns to Thomas from Thomas's encounter to future generations of Jesus followers to assure us that we are blessed, and that just as Mary and Thomas encounter the living God, so we can as well, finding life in his name. We may not get to put our hands in the physical wounds of Jesus. We may not see him outside his tomb. We may live in the moments of Christ being with us in unrecognizable forms. We will still have questions, like Mary and Thomas. Unanswered grief, a pervading sense of the absence of God, doubt that Jesus is truly who he says he is. We may feel angered and frustrated that despite doing everything right, we still feel no consolation. These questions continue rippling through future generations of Jesus followers. But I think the text today assures us that we are not alone, even when we feel most alone. Jesus listens to our questions and hears our weeping, even when we think that God is absent. Jesus' answer to our grief and questions is to appear in our midst, despite our fear, despite locked doors, to hold out his own wounds, and invite us to place our hands in his. And when we have those moments of transcendence, of joy, of feeling those sacred moments of seenness, of God's presence becoming visible to us, we are not to hoard those moments to hold on to this mysterious resurrected God, but rather to turn back to our community and share it with others.